Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Indiscriminate News Network. I'm Jason St. Clair. All right, we got news from all over the place. Let's jump into it. I'm going to start with Iran. So, Iranian Foreign Minister General Soleimani's blood unites regional people against U.S. deployment. Last year, across the region from Iran to Iraq, India, and Pakistan, people showed disgust for murders of General Soleimani. Okay, this, by the way, I'm not taking sides. I'm just saying this is from an Iraqi paper just to see what, I'm sorry, an Iranian paper, just to show you how they're thinking. I know Soleimani was a psychopath, all right? I understand that, but I'm just going to say how they're looking at it. Okay. The foreign minister wrote its official Twitter page and released photographs of ceremonies held by regional nations to mourn General Soleimani's martyrdom last year. His blood united our region, stating opposition to the U.S. arrogance and presence, a real response to recklessness. The anger and unity still stand. The foreign ministry also said that they used the hashtag "We'll never forget, we'll never forgive," an emphasis to harsh revenge vowed by the Iranian people and officials after the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani. The Iranian foreign ministry had also a statement on the occasion, anniversary of the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani, on the Tuesday, underlined that Iraqi's parliament approved January beginning to end the American forces' presence in the region. By the cowardly assassination of General Soleimani, the U.S. committed a grave mistake, the Iranian foreign ministry wrote on an official Twitter page. Iraqi's MP vote to expel U.S. troops at the beginning of the end for the maligned presence in our region. Our region has suffered enough by the interventions of the U.S. outlaw regime. Lieutenant General Soleimani was assassinated in the U.S. drone strike in Baghdad International Airport in Iraq on Sunday. On January 3rd, 2020. The airstrike also martyred Deputy Commander Iraq Popularized Mobilization Forces Abdul Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two were martyred in an American airstrike that targeted their vehicle on the road to the airport. Five Iranian and five Iraqi military men were martyred by the missile fired by a U.S. drone at Baghdad International Airport. So, I'm just throwing it out there that they didn't forget. I do have a chance to actually interview a former Iranian resident who's living overseas now about General Soleimani, his take on him. So I'd love to bring him on when I get a chance and talk to him about how he feels about it. Not just like getting my point of view or directly from the Iranian government's point of view, but a person who is actually Iranian and, left that country because of a lot of bad things that were going on there, and get his take on it. So I'm trying to get that together for you guys. So, all right. So more stuff on Iran. So this is from Bloomberg. So what America has learned from Iranian social media. Most Americans have no idea who Nahid Shirabesh is, but in Iran, he's become a powerful symbol of resistance. A little year ago, she witnessed her son's murder at a government protest in Tehran. Last month, she released a video made at the location of his killing that went viral in Iran. So here's another take on it, right? Another take on Iran. When I spoke to her last month, she surprised me by thanking the Trump administration. They mentioned my son's name and my own name, and they supported my voice when my son was killed and I was in prison. President Donald Trump's Iran policy was designated mostly to coerce the regime into a better nuclear deal than the one it joined in 2015. U.S. imposed sanctions were not meant to pressure Iran's rulers to release political prisoners or allow a referendum on the powers of the supreme leader, as Iranian activists have been demanding for years. Even if Trump's policy has succeeded, which it didn't, Iranians will still be stuck with their oppressors. That said, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has called the regime's human rights abuses. He highlighted its corruption and told the stories of dissidents and victims. Most intriguing, has empowered a small staff at the State Department to use Iranian social media to help craft a U.S. public diplomacy with Iranians. This is where Shirabesh comes in. A year ago, Pompeo mentioned the murder of Shirabesh's son, Poya Bakhtari, at a little covered event on human rights in Iran. The State Department made sure that the speech was translated and promoted on the U.S. Farsi language social media accounts. The new approach owes a lot to Mora Namdar, an Iranian American Pompeo met in 2018. A lawyer by training, Namdar was hired that year as an advisor to Brian Hook, the U.S. envoy to Iran. Namdar and a social media guru named Len Kordovsky soon took over the State Department's Farsi language Instagram and Telegram accounts, using them to gauge which message resonated with the Iranian public. Pompeo's mention of Bakhtari was an example of how this process worked. Namdar had noticed how this particular story was trending and pressed Pompeo to include it in both his speech. Likewise, the State Department's 2019 decision to ban visas for both senior regime officials and their families was driven by social media posts inside Iran expressing anger that the Iranian elites were able to attend U.S. and Western universities while many Iranians were cut from these schools. This counts as a small but meaningful change. The State Department had generally used the Farsi social media accounts as a broadcast platform, a way to reinforce what it was already saying. The department's new approach and threatened social media as a channel to what Iranians thought they could learn about their own regime and U.S. policy. Okay, some news out of China. China is leveraging the coronavirus vaccine to pressure Turkey to deport the Uyghur Muslims back to repression. So Chinese communist officials are applying significant pressure on Turkey to ratify a treaty that would allow the deportation of the Uyghurs, I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, sorry, fleeing the systematic repression underway in Xinjiang. Activists and supporters say that they're using a coronavirus vaccine to do so. The Chinese are really trying hard to get into Turkey's that community. They have spies and everything, said Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation senior fellow Adrian Zenz, an expert on Chinese abuse of the Uyghurs. And they will use significant backdoor pressure behind the scenes that have them ratify this agreement. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan agreed to extradition treaty in 2017, but the pact hasn't taken force yet. China's nominal legislation ratified the treaty on Sunday, the same day that delivery of Chinese-made coronavirus vaccine was delayed in Beijing, raising the suspicion that Chinese officials are threatening access to the vaccine in order to ensure the Turkish parliament is backing of the agreement. Sounds like politics to me already. Beijing appears to be leveraging not only the potential Chinese investment in Turkey, but also the supply of Sinovac vaccines to influence Turkish foreign policy. Jeez Louise, dude. Bastard. Okay. There we go. This is a take on Instacart. All those, people running around filling up those carts for everybody. This is from the New Republic diet. It's like a soapbox kind of like article. So Instacart is a parasite and a sham. The gig company, like many of its peers, has seen business skyrocket during the pandemic while exploiting workers and even failing to turn a profit. The pandemic has devastated a wide swath of the U.S. economy, causing more than 22 million job losses. Obviously, we all know that. But some companies have thrived amid the catastrophe. Indeed, they thrived because of it. Instacart, the grocery delivery service, is booming with sales up 500% year over year, and the company's cruising to a $17.7 billion valuation. Their workforce of mostly paid low contract workers has swelled to 500,000 people, while the company's taken about $500 million investment since March. Yet somehow Instacart is also losing unimaginable sums of money. In 8 years of business, Instacart has had 1 month of profitability in April 2020. That's after raising $2.4 billion total investment capital. And now, add to their problem, supermarkets probably are tiring of Instacart's high fees, usually more than 10%. "We don't think we make money from an Instacart order," Mark Scogan, CEO of Scogan Foodlighter Incorporated. Instacart isn't an outlier. Tech companies from Uber to Lyft to Grubhub remain in business only because they have access to a vast stream of cheap labor and money from investors who are confident they'll make up their losses on a future IPO driven by irrational exuberance. DoorDash, which leads the food delivery market, lost $600 million in 2019 and had its first profitable quarter this year before sliding back into the red. After a buzzy IPO caused the stock price to spike early in December, its value has steadily declined. Like its peer, DoorDash has been accused of gouging workers and merchants alike while failing to generate significant revenue. Okay, some news out of Cuba. They left Cuba for the U.S. in November, and no one has seen them since. A group of 70 people left Northwest Cuba on November 9th and has not been seen or heard from again. According to several people with knowledge of the incident, the situation highlights the risk of Cubans who are willing to take a risk to cross the Florida Straits in mostly unseaworthy craft to escape the Castro regime. This is despite U.S. policy changing 3 years ago and no longer affording Cubans who make landfall in the state's refugee status. I understand their plight, but I also want to send the message that you are risking your life and getting knocked off the boat and eaten by sharks, said Ramon Sal Sanchez, leader of the pro-democracy group. You risk getting picked up by the U.S. Coast Guard and we'll take you back, where you start from zero, walking around from the stigma that you tried to leave. Repeal of wet foot, dry foot Cuban policy. In January 2017, the Obama administration, in one of its last foreign policy decisions, repealed the wet foot, dry foot policy that allowed anyone from Cuba who made it to U.S. soil to stay and apply for permanent residency after a year. Those caught at sea were returned to Cuba. Now, whether stopped on land or sea, Cubans who enter the U.S. without a visa are sent back. But people keep doing it because the conditions are so dire that in repression in the economy and repression with the economy. The U.S. Coast Guard confirmed Tuesday that it searched for the group starting November 10th before calling off the search 8 days later. With overdue cases, we keep the search going on and exhaust all of our available information. Oh, boy, yes. The Coast Guard did not know the number of people on the boat, but friends say the family provided the Miami Herald with a list of 17 names of young men they embarked on the dangerous journey. They're all from the same neighborhood in Cardenas. A neighbor of the father of the young men who told the Herald the tight-knit community is concerned over the uncertainty of the traveler's fate. Some say they're in the Bahamas, while others say they're in Guantanamo Bay or hiding, concerned about the repercussions they're faced for leaving the communist island nation. Okay, I'm going to finish off with this one. Trump pardon of Blackwater Iraq contractors violates international law. This is from Reuters. U.S. President Donald Trump pardoned of four American men convicted of killing Iraqi civilians while working as contractors in 07 violated U.S. obligations under international law, U.N. human rights experts said on Wednesday. Nicholas Slatton was convicted of first-degree murder, while Paul Slow, Evan Liberty, and Dustin Hurd were convicted of voluntary and attempted manslaughter over the incident in which U.S. contractors opened fire in busy traffic in Baghdad Square, killing 14 unarmed Iraqi civilians. Civilians. The four contractors who work for the private security firm Blackwater, owned by the brother of Trump's education secretary, I did not know that, were included in a wave of pre-Christmas pardons announced by the White House. Pardon the Blackwater contractors, an affront to justice, and the victims of the Nisour Square massacre and their families. The Geneva Conventions oblige states to hold war criminals account for their crimes, even when they act as private security contractors. These pardons violate U.S. obligations under international law, more broadly undermine humanitarian and human rights at a global level. By allowing private security contractors to operate with impunity in armed conflicts, states will be emboldened to circumvent obligations under humanitarian law, they said. Pardons were strongly criticized by many in the United States. General David Petraeus, probably saying his name, and Ryan Croker, respectively, commander of the U.S. forces and U.S. ambassador in Iraq at the time of the incident, called Trump's pardons hugely damaging, an action that tells the world that Americans abroad can commit the most heinous crimes with impunity. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. This is Jason with the Indiscriminate News Network. Take care, and you'll hear from me soon. Bye.